Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, I'm joined by writer and podcaster, Eleanor Gray. Hello.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine. We've got quite the day for you.
We do. It's funny because you proposed January the 13th. And I was, you know, any day you were going to suggest to me, I was going to say, yes, of course. And then I realised what day it was, and it was literally the most important day of the entire documentary. So thank you very much.
I'm keen to hear your thoughts. Oh, where do we start? It's Monday morning, and previous Friday, George had quit, and they had a meeting at Ringo's on Sunday, which sadly ended badly. Suddenly, they're coming into Twickenham, and it's not just about the future of the project, it's about the future of the band.
Well, this is very interesting, Chris, and I would like to get your thoughts on this, about why was the contents of Sunday's meeting not addressed in the documentary?
There's a brief chat, isn't there? Because when Paul and Linda arrive, Linda says, I have a feeling that half the stuff Yoko said yesterday, she was talking for John, and I don't think he really believed any of that. And then Paul said, well, John didn't talk, Yoko talks for John, and in the middle of that, George left. So that's all we get, but it's quite a lot.
Well, it's very interesting because watching part one, I was thinking a lot about, I was trying to come at it from a blank slate and trying to come at it as someone, I don't know, maybe who's not read and thought about it as much as I have. And I'm like, what is the breaking point? Why would George leave at this time? And my feeling watching part one was that I was sort of quite overwhelmed by it, actually. I was kind of overwhelmed by sort of micro gestures of aggression. I was sort of overwhelmed by John being so mean to George. I know everybody would sort of dismiss it as Scouser humour. And it was just, I think maybe there was something about the vividness in which they were portrayed. You know, we were sort of seeing them more lifelike than we'd ever seen them before. And we were sort of in the inner circle. And I could feel the tension, and which is why I could only watch it in bits. The way I was feeling was that he left because John was being antagonistic and Paul was being bossy. And then we have this meeting on the 13th, and all the discussion seems to suggest that the problem was with Yoko and that Yoko is speaking on John's behalf. It's just sort of, it's a bit of a non sequitur because up until this point, we haven't really seen Yoko speak at all.
The editing on this, because I'm sure you've heard them as well, the Nagra tapes that have been doing the rounds for years. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more of Yoko on those. And she literally says hardly anything at all in the Peter Jackson version. And I'm wondering if it's partly, at least, anybody mentions Yoko online and then you get thousands of trolls zooming in with all the usual rubbish. And I'm wondering if that was a deliberate thing just to keep her role in this as minimal as possible. And there is actually more. She did get more involved in it. Not that much, but she did have a presence.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there were certainly discussions in which she was speaking about the location of the live show. And in that discussion, John didn't really contribute to that. But saying that, I think more of the pressure was in regards to sort of board meetings and things that perhaps were taking place outside of the studio. So it's interesting that in Ken McNabb's book, he describes sort of more what happens at this meeting. And he uses quite sort of charged language. He says, Harrison's unbridled rage at Lennon's abandonment of his own sense of self, won by Martin, he itemizes his complaints. Lennon has very little decent new material to offer up for Get Back. He was fed up. George was fed up with being treated like some starstruck kid. And Yoko had now become John's mouthpiece in the studio and at band meetings. And he felt like she had no right to be there. And John's deferment to Yoko at every God-given opportunity was no longer tolerable. And so I think a lot of it had to do with Lennon's sort of artistic and personal withdrawal as such. I mean, so one thing that really struck me in part one is how sort of John wasn't there in a sort of an emotionally present sense. I was really left with feeling John was always talking about communication, and the point of this was communication, that we need to communicate a point. And he was very big on sort of heightened awareness, almost to the point of, you know, telepathic communication. I'm big on communication, but almost to the point that we don't need to verbally communicate. I'm so big on it. And I think Paul was really big on engagement. I think Paul wanted someone to sit with him to the extent that he was sort of prepared to show anybody and everybody how it's done. He wanted somebody to sit with him and really engage with what he was doing.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, from logistically, bear in mind, they're now 5 days away from the dress rehearsal that's been planned and six before the scheduled live shows, and they're now in this position. A lot of today is basically them waiting for John to arrive because there's some confusion as to who's going to come. So, I mean, initially only Ringo has turned up. Mm. And there's just silly things like this. There's so many of them throughout all of Get Back, where the woman on the tea trolley, and he just gives her a little smile. Hello, Teetles, by the way, if you're listening. And Ringo, and he's singing Cilla Black's You're My World, which is very sweet.
Yeah, it seems like there's a humour and a despondency that sort of coalesces quite well with the Beatles. And this is sort of, I mean, it's quite a sort of tragic situation that they find themselves in. I think this sort of punctuality issue is really interesting. And it was something that really struck me the first time that I watched it, was that Lennon's lateness seems to correspond with him being slack. I mean, but they sort of fail to mention that Paul was like an hour and a half late on the first day. Not a big deal made about that. But there seems to be, and sort of sometimes they deal with it with quite a lot of humour, sort of like Lennon wears your songs and then sort of a boom mic swings between them. And, you know, sort of, so at the same time, they're trying to get on each other's back, you know, John's back to like, can you do your work? Can you learn the lyrics? Can you bring some songs? And they're sort of bullying him to do it. Well, he has to do it. This is a job, but he has to get it done. Mm. But at the same time, I don't think we get sort of a proper representation of that because the cameras are around and they're being recorded. They can obscure this with guitars and things like that, but they were under the thumb and John wasn't doing very much.
Because when Michael Lindsay-Hogg arrives, he's sitting with Ringo, sorry, and Kevin Harrington, the one and only, everybody loves him. And he tells them he's called to see if Paul and John are coming in. And again, it's odd about this communication thing that John's saying, because there's none here. Because Ringo says he'd spoken to the night before and they both said they were coming in. But according to Michael, Neil Aspinall had told him that no one was coming. It's that communication thing. It's frustrating because it's throughout all of this, all of the Get Back. It's just that, oh, come on, just stop all this bickering and all the passive-aggressive stuff. Communicate with each other.
Well, it's so unclear. I mean, even just in this minor confrontation, literally when they're sitting down on these deck chairs, is his phone off the hook or did you leave a message on his machine? I mean, there are sort of two differing reports of people who are there. And it's very unclear what the situation is.
Mm. Michael's telling Ringo about the document, because Ringo said, have you got enough for a good documentary at least? And Michael, I love him, he says, depends how liquid the situation is. In other words, if we tell it like it is, we got a good documentary, but if we're hiding, we don't. And we just have a couple of days when things didn't work out, and that's it. So it's weird, they're all self-aware of the footage that we're watching. Apart from the possibility of the band splitting, they're aware that they're making a film. And is it usable? It just seems a very bizarre way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, my band and livelihood and my friendships are over, but have you got a good film at least? Is there something you can do with this? But it's very interesting in light of, I watched Let It Be recently, and I was very struck by, firstly, sort of how funereal it seems, no spoiler alert, at least in the introduction, but it's also responsible for perhaps the more happier moments than that we remember. Like my particular favorite sequence from it is where Paul is trying to describe the microtonal guitar solo. And I've got a feeling, I really enjoy how that sort of communicated. There are all sorts of other things, George helping Ringo with Octopus's Garden, and that's included in Get Back as well. Sorry, no spoilers. But there are some really endearing moments that don't necessarily support this was a terrible, gloomy time, but I think there's so much in the image, in the sort of this grainy, desaturated print that we see, and also the context in which it was released. It was sort of around the time people knew of the context of the Beatles breaking up and stuff like that. So anyway, I digress.
And the perfect timing, it's so cinematic, where the delivery driver arrives with a bouquet of flowers for Mr. Harrison. And everybody just laughs at the futility of it all. And they're from one of the Hare Krishna guys.
Mm.
Very sweet. Then Paul and Linda do arrive. And it's, again, it's all the little minutiae. Glyn Johns announces his wife's confirmed as pregnant. And you generally feel, congratulations. You know, someone we didn't really know at all just a few hours ago. I was generally chuffed for him.
Yeah, I think it's one of these elements that really add to this collagey, accidental, lived life feeling that you get from the documentary, that everything is sort of, this is extremely well crafted, but at the same time, it's these sort of incidental bits of dialogue which make it feel like everything's just fallen together and this is just exactly how it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to the bit that we mentioned about Linda and Paul talking about the meeting. And it's interesting because Paul then immediately defends John and Yoko. And it's a long old speech saying, you know, their point is they're trying to like be as near together as they can. They want to stay together. So it's all right. Let the young lovers stay there. It goes against the grain of all we've heard before, or throughout the 70s and 80s at least. But it's very touching, and I guess a lot of it's editing, but Linda just puts her hand into Paul's arm, and he sort of instinctively sings, "Build me a buttercup," by Foundations.
Yeah.
After he's sort of mentioned that, you know, John's thing now, obviously if it came to a push between Yoko and the Beatles, it's Yoko. Again, that self-awareness.
It's very, very sad. And as you say, this is quite a clever and inclusive edit. I think it's a very meaningful moment that really, again, shows Paul's willingness to come to both John and Yoko's defense. But I think he does that for the preservation of the band. And basically, he sort of expresses that he's got no ill feeling towards Yoko. But just, he realizes that there's a correlation between Yoko being close to John and John feeling okay. And sort of the closer that she can be to him, the better that it is. I mean, if she's touching him, even better. So I think he spent a bit of time sort of psychoanalyzing the situation and also explaining, you know what, things aren't what they used to be. We're not on tour together. We're not in hotel rooms. And what made us special was this proximity and us being together all the time. That was a part of the magic, and we just don't have that proximity anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Michael's asking about that. He says musically we can play better than we ever have been. So
I dispute that. it's a lot of faffing around.
There is, so it's very in-depth conversations, and again they're being pretty open to Michael. They've worked with him a long time, so he's in their little circle now. But he's saying, you know, Yoko, she's great. She really is all right. They just want to be near each other. But Neil Aspinall jumps in. Yeah, but there's got to be a bit of compromise, and it's difficult, isn't it? Because you don't know what it was like. You can imagine, but you don't know what it was like. John and Yoko were so in love. And it's the four brothers, suddenly someone else has come in the gang.
Yeah. And I think you get more of a bigger perspective of this in, say, full transcripts of the Nagra Reels or like in Doug Sulpey's book. Basically, Neil, Linda and Paul all see Yoko as working her will through John, but they don't want to confront him about it. Paul and Neil see Yoko as talking for John, but when they talk to John, they're really talking to Yoko. So it's a really difficult, delicate situation. I think it's one that we can't even really address, I think, in this day and age, because I think, although you've mentioned that there's sort of a lot of Yoko hate online, it's sort of, I think the scales have sort of tipped the other way for me, where I follow a lot of people who really love her and advocate for her work and the positive influence that she had on John's life, etc. But it's very difficult to look at these sorts of discussions, listen to these sorts of tapes and figure out what was going on exactly and see that from an objective perspective.
Of course, yeah. And again, he openly talks about if the Beatles split, how ridiculous, you know, it's going to be comical 50 years' time that they broke because Yoko sat on an amp. And it's that self-awareness. It's stuff that we've read about for years in quotes, but to see it happening in real time, you're kind of feeling it a lot deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of don't want to foreshadow it, but certainly that sort of 30 seconds of silence of just looking at Paul, holding back his tears, and you can see that he's he's doing, I don't know about whether you know this, but if you like sucking your thumb or putting your hand to the lower part of your face is like a self-soothing mechanism. And, you know, he's in that thumb-sucking sort of a position. You can see his chest is shaking, you know, his eyes are watered up. And it's the longest 30 seconds in the entire documentary. It's incredibly hard to see him, Paul being so upset. And you can feel him at the moment, and you just want to put your hand on his shoulder and say, it's going to be okay. I mean, it's not going to be okay, but it's going to be all right.
Yeah, it is. It's astonishing, that moment. Again, Michael, he doesn't hold back when he wants to say something, but he's just saying, you know, do you think if you put any pressure on John that he'd go your way a bit more? And he says, I don't know. And it's just that quote, and then there were two. George has quit the band, but most of the conversation seems to be about John and his tentative role in the band rather than what we're going to do about George.
Yeah, and that's what I find really interesting about this, is what the conversation about is about. George has left the band, and for all intents and purposes, Yoko's not an issue, and then they suddenly come back part two, and it seems like Yoko's presence, or at least connection with John, is the issue. So you've got to assume that there has to be some connection, correlation as to why, this is why George is upset. I don't know, if primary, secondary sources are to be believed, this was one of the issues. I mean, there were many issues, but also I'm struck by the canteen conversation again seems to have no relationship with this discussion right here. They seem to be very frightened to confront John about his behaviour.
Yeah, and it's a moment after Paul's sort of breaking down, really. Mal comes over, says John's on the phone, and Paul literally is like a bullet, rushes off.
I think this is a bit of editing. I've got to say, yeah, I think in the actual tapes, I think there's a bit of time between the and then there were two and then there's other discussion, but the way Jackson created it, he sort of got it, you know, Mal rushes in at exactly the right time. So he swoops in to, you know, to save the day, as he often does.
Mal would do that.
Yes.
There's a lovely little bit as well between Linda and Michael. When Linda says, I'm speaking as a fan. Michael says, me too, and I'm a bigger fan than you.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, should we fight about that?
What's great about it is the sort of it's very funny. I mean, the way that Michael Lindsay Hogg is sort of portrayed in part one, at least, and in this interaction specifically, that he's sort of so pompous and so pedantic, almost this very comical figure. But then at the same time, you really feel for him trying to pin the Beatles down as to a location, what they're doing, what they're going to do. They've got 5 days left. What are they going to do? But I think this, I'm a bigger fan than you are, we're really sort of preempting the Twitter space of sort of reply guys and mansplainers and dudes coming around saying, I know much more about the Beatles than you do. And I'm like, yeah, it seems like a, sounds like a familiar arena.
So Paul returns from the phone call, says, yep, John is coming in. And Michael says, yeah, unless he's allowed to say what he thinks, you know, if he thinks things are wrong, he'll abdicate his role. And I was like, Paul, not another strike. And I found that interesting, the use of the word strike, because it's like they don't consider George has left. They see he's on strike. So there's no finality to it, perhaps.
Yeah, I guess strike would suggest that, and he uses sort of working conditions, that strike would suggest that the working conditions aren't right. And I think we understand more about sort of the environment of Twickenham, that it was sort of a very cold space, but at the same time, very hot under the lights, and that it was too big and the cameras were very invasive, and it just, the vibes weren't right. So I think there were many things contributing to George's feeling of ill will towards the environment and the place. And certainly I think Twickenham was a sort of a big reason why he didn't want to be there.
Yeah. Michael, he's probably one of my favourite characters in all this, because they have started to become characters in movies now, it's for me. But his quote, he said, I thought the other day I might leave. I thought, they won't even notice. So charming. And then there's more talk about possible venues. Again, he's desperate. He's supposed to be making this, and there's only three of them, two of them at the moment. And Glyn says he likes Brighton Beach, And Linda sort of pops in. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And Paul replied, no, come on, you stay out of this, Yoko. So again, there's another little clue maybe to what the Ringo meeting was like around Ringo's. Don't know. Then we come to John has arrived and possibly one of the least ethical bits of recording available. But bless Michael Lindsay Hogg, we've got them. You know, how you can question his ethics, but we've got them where he's hidden the microphone in a...
I've got to say that my breath was taken away when I saw the side of the canteen. I mean, first, like, my first thought went to Teedles, obviously. So if there's a Beatles-related tea break or lunch break, huh? But also, incredible that this footage, well, not footage, but like audio was able to be captured and that we can listen to it now. But at the same time, I find it very hard to follow their train of thought.
Mm.
And I don't know, I need to read a lot of transcripts. I need to listen to them a lot of time to really get to the core of what they're trying to say to one another. Do you find this, Chris?
It is all over the place. Yeah. It's a simple question. Paul's saying, so where's George? And John's like, well, he doesn't want to be here. It's so ambiguous because Paul says, he's just said, I'll do it at home. It's do what at home? So he's going to record. I guess he's got recording equipment, but he hasn't got a band. He's on his own. So you don't know. And then the conversation veers away from George, doesn't it? Into John, really, and Paul's treatment of George.
Mm.
And also John's treatment of George. But also the underlying thing for me is Paul. John's not happy with Paul. It's a bizarre conversation. Like, there's so much going on in them, they can't really express it. But it's ultimately, they're all aware that, you know, they could split at any moment. But it's, I agree, it's a very strange conversation.
Yeah, it's very odd. I mean, at the same time, it's very revealing because we hear them talking in a way that they don't usually speak to one another. But one thing that struck me watching it the first time was that the dynamic was much like, if you imagine a school project and the nerdy SWAT has been grouped with the lazy, you know, the kids who are too cool for school and they don't want to do any work.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they resent the nerdy kid who's trying to do all the work and trying to get the project done on time. And so this might just be my projection on the entire situation, but that was how I felt watching it. And I felt a great sympathy with Paul because he just wanted to get the project done. And it meant that he had to, you know, he had to say how the song should go. But at the same time, second viewing, on the morning that George left, I'm like, he's literally making no sense. I mean, the way he's trying to communicate his musical directions are so abstract.
Mm.
Also, because he kind of doesn't know what he's talking about either. He kind of doesn't know what to achieve. So I'm talking about one specific scenario. But in terms of this conversation.
Yeah.
It's very difficult because basically there was an unspoken situation where John was assumed to be the leader, but because of what was happening during the White Album, Paul became more domineering and became kind of the unspoken leader of the group, I suppose. And I think it was sort of a role that he didn't want to take up, but because John was less inclined to be more active. But in some ways, it's just a kind of a power battle in that regard. I don't know if that's sort of a citationless speech. Chris, I don't know how you feel about that.
Mm. So, there's a moment, isn't there, where Paul says, John, you know, you are the leader, you know, whether you believe it or not, you are the leader. It's sort of like Paul's reasserting John's position in the band, because John doesn't really seem to care. He's so in love with Yoko that the band, which Paul's picked up on as well, are almost secondary.
Mm.
And John and Paul's kind of like saying, when he says that, I think he's saying, look, John, you are the leader. I can't be expected to be doing all this on my own. And, you know, we need to work together, or you need to take control, which was never going to happen.
Yeah.
Because it hadn't done for years.
But also at the same time is that not only is John the leader, Paul is in the position of pleasing the leader. You know, he's a people pleaser, and I think he's deeply attuned to try and create things that he knows will impress John. It's like in the conversation earlier, he's talking about how he finds himself writing songs about white walls because he thinks that will please John and Yoko, but obviously it doesn't. So I think it's in a it's a difficult position trying to please someone who's completely non-responsive, who's checked out, who's not interested. And, you know, this could largely be due to Yoko, but also because of the heroin. And this is something heroin isn't really touched on Get Back either. And sort of the extent to which Lennon's drug use has influenced his behaviour, you know, is something that's up for conjecture.
Yeah. John, there's a line where he says, I'd have to tell George and I would just say, you know, like you do about me, I'm Paul McCartney and a lot of the times you were right and a lot of the times you were wrong. Same as we all of us are. But I can't see the answer to that because you've suddenly got it all. And Paul's saying, well, I really don't want to. And John's, well, all right, I'm just telling you what I think. I don't think the Beatles revolve around the four people. It's like being in an effing job.
Yeah.
And Paul's like, the main thing is you have always been boss. Now I've been secondary boss. And Paul's really forced, you know, always. It's a strange position because we know ultimately what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I find that what John says about, I don't think the Beatles revolve around four people. And I think the idea of perhaps maybe having Yoko included in the band, just to say like Eric Clapton was included in the band for the White Album. I think maybe John and perhaps George saw the Beatles as perhaps becoming a more fluid unit where more people could come in and out. And obviously that's what happened with Billy Preston. But it's hard to say. But you also saw, I saw things in part one that had me distressed in terms of how Paul responded to people when people presented him with new material. And I think that was probably what was the most upsetting thing. In terms of, if you look at sort of George presenting I, Me, Mine, you say, you can have it or not, I don't care, I'll put it in my musical, you do with it what you will. It's very sort of, I think it would have been very upsetting for George to have this huge cache, you know, 10 years worth of material, and sort of that being dismissed, but then Paul is sort of leaning hard on John, who hasn't really got anything.
Yeah, I think John's the most dismissive of that, isn't he? Because he's literally like, move along, son.
Yeah, and like sort of that, saying it's a waltz. I tell you, sort of probably the most interesting thing that I found, at least in my research, was reevaluating the waltz scene in Let It Be. Or sort of John and... Because I remember years ago thinking, oh, isn't it nice? They're having a nice dance. And then the narrative of that got changed. It goes, no, actually, they're making fun of George.
Mm.
And then you read the script... You read the Niagara tapes and then it's like, no, actually, Paul is saying, wouldn't it be nice if you guys danced around? That would be a nice inclusion in the film. So you get a sort of sense this is more staged. So it's interesting how this narrative keeps on evolving. And I don't think Get Back is necessarily the definitive take, but I think it's just another hallmark. It's another bookmark in the history that we can just look back and say, this is our interpretation at this time and place.
It's amazing with the Beatles, isn't it? Everything they release, the fans just want more. We've got like 8 hours. No!
Where's the 18-hour cut?
So, after lunch, John suggests that they meet with George again. Ringo says, well, he was going anyway. Bless him. I love that. And there's another cinematic moment. Ringo suggests, you think we should just quickly phone to see if he's there? And then this is a little line, very quiet, but John asks Yoko, have you got any pep pills? And she says, yes, that's a good idea. And also try. And he said, yeah, none of that. I'm working. Surprised they kept that in.
Well, it's
that's
interesting.
That's what it was.
I think I saw a post that, with, do you know Spanish Tony?
No.
Spanish Tony was Keith Richards' drug dealer. And apparently there were photos of him lurking around the set on the 13th. And and so there's a sort of the thought that at least Mark Lewinson has said that John wasn't taking drugs on set. He was too lucid for that, but certainly after the sessions at night. So there's a suggestion that on the night of the 13th, John was taking heroin, and that accounted for the hangover during the two junkies interview on the 14th.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. What a time.
I know.
So after speaking to Mal, Ringo announces George has gone to Liverpool and he'll be back on Wednesday. Another bombshell.
So that's interesting because during like the canteen tape where John says it's a festering wound and yesterday we allowed it to go even deeper and we didn't give him any bandages. I've read a transcript, I think it's in the Get Back book, where basically it's at that point Yoko says, you can get him back if you want to. And so it's very, like, it's hard to reconcile these sources and see what was correct and who was there, and I don't know. I get the impression this was perhaps played around a little bit.
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So until then, what do we do? Well, just carry on, continue rehearsing, which they do. And that's such a Beatle thing, isn't it? Yeah, right, press on. And then they're back doing Get Back. And interestingly here, we're seeing some more of the lyrical development with Loretta Marsh at this time.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's the way that the words, they're analysing the words. It's got to be a sharp word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting to see. I think that's one of sort of the endorphin-inducing things about Get Back, is to see Paul McCartney at work, just to see him experimenting with permutations and just music sort of pouring out of him. And it's not always good, but he's almost like sifting through grains of sand, trying to find the right word. I think the Arizona link may have something to do with Linda, because she went to the University of Arizona. So I think, and they eventually had a ranch there. So I don't know. But it's interesting. I think that's sort of the joy of the viewer. You know what it's going to become eventually. And you can see that it's just within... it's just within your hands. You can see, oh no, just it's twos on, just change it. And I think you get that so often. I mean, they're not usually working with skeletons. Usually the songs that they're playing resemble enough of the final product for you to know how it doesn't take much to hone it into its sort of final incarnation, if that makes sense.
Definitely, yeah. Yes. It's again, when you say about Tucson, John says, are you sure that's in Arizona?
Yes.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And it's obviously, he knows because of Linda, but I love the fact he knows it's where they make High Chaparral. He knew that. What a geek. I love it. And then they're still looking for a home to last. And then Ringo comes, looking for a blast from the past from Ringo, which is awesome.
I love how he says it in such a like a deadpan, atonal kind of a way as well. It's like, I kind of wish that was included, but it's nice. I mean, it's very fun to see how non-precious they are about lyrics.
Mm.
You know, it's often when they, you know, sometimes there's an idle moment. They say, oh, sort of Get Back and Don't Let Me Down sort of go together, and Oh Darling and Two of Us. Yeah, it kind of makes sense, but it sort of comes in those idle moments. But at the same time, I can see that they've got this deadline. they've just got to get the songs done.
Now they've suddenly been pushed back because of George. They can't do anything until Wednesday.
I just say...
Again, I feel sorry for Michael.
I think just move the Magic Christian until March. It's really... Or maybe just give them... Because it's not so long since they just finished the White Album, and that was an epic piece of work. I mean, it didn't give them any time to breathe, any time to recover. But I was sort of thinking, I'm like, why did they go back so quickly after the White Album? And I found these little quotes that were like, John said the act of working inspires them to work. All right. George said it's good to work again after the White Album. And Ringo said, if you stay at home, you don't get inspired. So that was what was happening at the beginning, of all this. Yeah. And now they're in this mess and they still don't know where they're going to do this concert.
Well, I guess they were so enthused. I think a lot of it was the Hey Jude's footage, because they seem to really relish that. And obviously they later announced they were going to do the Roundhouse gig. So they obviously felt that need to have a live audience and play, do something live. So they really seem to be enthused by that. As we know, later in 69 with John playing live. And I can kind of see why they did it. And I suppose maybe they thought, well, because you think, what would they have played at the Roundhouse gig? It would have been mostly, I guess, stuff from the White Album.
Mm.
And I'm guessing it like two guitars, bass and drums. That would be things like, well, Your Blues, which he did on the Rock and Roll Circus. Mm-hmm. Revolution, maybe. There's a few tracks off the White Album that they could have played live rather than Pepper, which, you know, at the time would have been nigh on impossible for them. So maybe that was the drive behind it, just that need to once they got that in their heads, right, well, if we're going to do a live show, maybe we can do a making of documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And just suddenly the making of documentary is now what we're watching all these years ago.
Yeah. Or later. Yeah. And I think sort of, I mean, one word that's been used to describe this session that I find very emotive is rudderless. And I think that really sums it up to a T, that if they just had some element of decisiveness and an element of focus, I mean, not telling the Beatles what to do here, but it really suffered from a lack of that. And I think Paul's attempt to sort of stand up and be decisive was perhaps to their detriment, and they resented him for it. But I don't see what the issue would have been with, say, going back to the cavern. I mean, it seems like...
Yes.
I mean, talking in a more holistic sense, sort of get back, you know, they're talking about get back to their roots, getting back to the rock and roll. There's a lot of talking about, you know, Hamburg and using old speakers that they used then and all this kind of stuff. I even feel sort of John's thing with rock and roll, I think that maybe this is the whole concept of having a rock and roll album was something to please John, I feel, ultimately.
Mm.
But I'm just saying this as a citationless kind of a thing. Like, I feel that in my heart of hearts. But just sort of like John regarding sort of that he only really likes rock and roll. And maybe if they just returned to their roots as sort of like a live rock and roll band instead of working with, say, I don't know. I feel the way they treated George Martin was very poor during these sessions, actually.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, very distasteful. But I don't know. And I feel like maybe Paul was trying to appease John in trying to do more of a rock and roll album, more of a live album, which means the decision to get it overproduced by Phil Spector seems to be
a
bit of a gobsmacking decision. I mean, at the end of the day, if you sort of wanted a raw recording, why would you do that?
I played Let It Be the other day, and it takes on an entirely different... Just everything seems so weird about it, because you've seen some of the songs, how they evolved, and them actually recording them. And then you suddenly get Long and Winding Road, Across the Universe, I'm In Mine as well, and they just seem completely wrong. So wrong with all that orchestration. More so than ever.
It seems really funny. I don't think a lot of people have done this, but... I tend to listen to Let It Be naked a lot more, I think, than the ordinary person would, because I think mostly because I think I know the story, and I know that Paul really didn't want to have all those overdubs. And so I kind of treat Let It Be naked as sort of almost like the definitive product in spite of having grown up with Let It Be. But at the same time, it's sort of, these are all markers in the story. They have their own place. And they represent their own time.
So Michael Lindsay-Hogg, he wants to talk about the show again.
Again.
And it's decided now to put everything back a full week. So now the live shows are moved from the 19th and 20th of January to the 26th and 27th. And John makes a very notable little comment here. And he says to show his commitment that he'll be back first thing in the morning. He'll leave his favourite guitar in Twickenham. And I think that's a really touching moment after that conversation where Paul's saying, you know, Yoko comes first over the Beatles. It's quite a poignant thing, really. He's saying, right, I'm not leaving you guys. I'm leaving my guitar here. I'm going to be here tomorrow. And I think you can read quite a bit into that.
Yeah, it's quite a poignant deposit, I guess you could say. It's sort of, I guess it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, and he does it in a bit of a light-hearted way. And there's a nice riposte from Paul as well, basically saying that he'll do the same with his Hofner bass. And there's that beautiful moment where he shows the old Candlestick Park set list that's still on the side, and like, this is the sign of a man who hasn't lost his faith.
Yeah, very moving. So, what a day.
What a day.
They've achieved...
Nothing.
Achieved nothing. Michael Lindsay-Hogg's got a few more grey hairs.
I think Paul ages about 2 years in the space of about 2 weeks. And when it begins, I'm like, oh, he's quite, you know, he's quite the
man. But it's, for years, the Get Back story was very authored, wasn't it? It was just the same old thing. Yeah, they fell out. That was it. And then they gave it one more chance, made Abbey Road. But there's so much more to it than that. There's so much more that... They're aware that they might split, but they want to keep going. They're torn. All of them are torn. Ringo wants to carry on. Paul wants to carry on. But both John and George, the story, it had to end, didn't it, really?
Yeah. And I suppose this is the reason why I dwell in this era much less than other eras, because of the inevitability of it. But at the same time, I think this is a good lesson for people who do like to research sort of Beatles history, to realise that it's not black and white, and that you realise that there are many contributing factors to why people feel a certain way on a certain day. I was talking with They May Be Parted. He was saying, oh, you know, after the Get Back sessions, George had his tonsils out.
Yes.
So, you know, he probably wasn't in a very happy place if he's, you know, just had his tonsils out. So, yeah, I mean, there are lots of personal issues. George's home life as well, things weren't going on very well. Domestically, things with Patty and stuff like that. And so I think I've relied very heavily on, say, things the anthology, because that was sort of really what got me into the Beatles growing up, and especially the Beatles Anthology Revisited, which is sort of my favourite sort of anonymous radio documentary series. But it's interesting to see the anthology's take on this, which is very calm and very diplomatic and very mature.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul is very much takes responsibility, saying, look, I realise that I probably came across as being domineering, but I was just being enthusiastic. There's a lot of pathos and contrition there. And it's, I don't know, in light of what we know, it's very sad. But at the same time, their memory of it doesn't seem quite aligned with what we know now.
It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. Why aren't these people reading their diaries with... enthusiasm.
Eleanor Gray, thanks so much. Pretend you are Michael Lindsay Hogg.
Yes.
On the end of 13th of January 1969. What would you be thinking?
I'm going to kidnap them and we're going to go to Libya. It's because it's not just a decision of like we show up on this day in this place. There are logistical concerns that need to take place. Whether they hire a ship or whether they go to North Africa, or whether they go to Brighton Beach, there are things that need to happen for these things to... There are arrangements that need to be made. So, yes, he is annoying. they're very, very hard to pin down. What would you do, Chris?
I would probably do what he did, which was for the next, till 1982, went on to produce loads of Rolling Stones videos.
Sounds like an appropriate escape, but it's very interesting. I mean, have you seen his film Two of Us?
Yes.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. And that's a widely praised account of sort of the meeting of John and Paul at the Dakota. Mm. And was it 75 or 76?
76.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And that's sort of lauded as sort of a biopic, which is meant to be very accurate and very on point with how they may have, you know, it's sort of joking about them going on Saturday Night Live for a very, very small sum. But it's a very interesting film.
Anyway. Get Back.
Get Back.
What do you think of it overall?
I think it's a stunning piece, and I think it's an evolving work. I think for people of like us, the meaning of it will change upon each viewing. And I think there's something about the beauty of the image, the clarity of the image, that does so much to, I guess, warm the heartstrings. I guess it's so nice to see them with such clarity, and it's nice to see them interact with each other and have small jokes and things like that. But by the same token, I found myself to be deeply affected by... I perceived microaggressions between the group that I suppose the rest of the Beatles community didn't really see. But saying that, I did watch it again, and then I saw that most of the the video was mismatched with the audio, and then I'm like, oh, it's fine, it's just all in my head. Yeah. So, and I think once you become attuned to this, when you look closely and you see that a lot of this is a construction, you sort of let go with the, okay, this is more of an impressionistic piece and shouldn't be taken as gospel.
Definitely. Eleanor Gray, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Chris. Hey!